I think our commitment for nonviolence and humanization is unconditional honesty.
Okay.
For me, this is how I see it. And that's not coming from weakness place, rather from a very strong place, actually. Nonviolence is much harder choice than violence.
Hi, I'm Mariam. Welcome to a candid conversation on Palestine, Israel, and Europe. Today, we are joined by Suleiman Khatib. In 2006, together with other former Palestinian and Israeli fighters, Suleiman co-founded Combatants for Peace, a grassroots movement committed to joint nonviolence and to ending the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories. Since then, the movement has led countless local and international initiatives working toward a just and peaceful future for everyone living in the region. Hello, Suleiman. Thank you for being here.
Hello, Mariam. Thanks for having me.
So there are many things that we could talk about today, but I'd like to focus on the history, the ideas, and the beliefs mm-hmm. behind Combatants for Peace, mm-hmm. and also take a closer look at some of the areas of your work on the ground. Mm-hmm. But let's begin with your personal story. So could you share a bit about your life, how you grew up, and what led you to co-found a joint Israeli-Palestinian movement?
Yeah, thank you, Mariam, for having me today. Actually, in Combatants for Peace, we usually start with a personal story and storytelling because we believe this is a very important strategy to use. It's very effective, usually. So, in a shortcut, my background, I born in Jerusalem. My family has lived in Jerusalem area, Jerusalem mountain, for generations and generations. So my family are really ancient family in the land. So I come from this long history and tradition of carrying, you know, the cause in our heart and in the spirit, and also belonging to this place, actually. Also, like, very familiar with the Palestinian, the local folklore. You know, my mom still do Tatriz broderie, which is like long, long tradition in our region. And very connected to the land, to the local tradition and to the land. I come also from activist family, actually. That also has a long history in fighting colonization, even during the British colonization time. So coming from that background, I become very active compared to my generation. I was like 13, 14. I joined the armed resistance. So at that time, I was really drawn to my energy, let's say, to... you know, like models of armed resistance, like Che Guevara and Arafat and these people. And at that time, I, as a person that seek freedom and liberation, the only way to liberate Palestine for me was armed struggle. That's honestly my background. And that means I organized like little group, throwing stones, cocktail Molotov. We attacked two Israelis. We stabbed two Israelis in order to take their weapon. And at this point, I was 14 and a half. So I was very young compared to other activists, to say. My older brother was in jail, so I had access to activists, like adult activists, let's say. I was affiliated with Fatah and BLO that led by Arafat. And then I ended up in jail. I was going through different stages in jail. The first stage is like the investigation time, which is a torture, physical and psychological torture. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you know, for people that listen, maybe they don't know the difference. If you were in jail in other countries, in other contexts, you're the bad guy. In our case, honestly, this is a military rule. So I was in a military court and a military jail. So the ages really doesn't really matter so much. So I want to put this in a context. I continue my activism in jail within my organization, and during the jail time, the prisoners were divided into different movements, different organizations. And in order to improve the daily life in jail, we actually do a lot of hunger strike, food hunger mm-hmm. strike. When I was 15, we done food hunger strike for 16 days. without food, just water and salt. That's why it's called mayo melh in Arabic. It's very famous, salt and water. And the last hunger strike was 17 days with 4,000 prisoners across all jails. It was very well secretly coordinated. And we always succeed to achieve our demands, which is improving the conditions in jail, like to have books, hot water, I don't know, like food and this and that, because that's how it works. Mm-hmm. And as non-violent strategy, food hunger strike was one of the strongest, like powerful non-violent strategy that we used. And as I said, it was always like in solidarity with the prisoners, a group action, and was always successful. And that's how I start to learn about non-violence practically. So maybe like in a shortcut, my background, like in, before jail, I practice violence, honesty, mm-hmm. as a strategy to reach my freedom and to liberate the land. And when I was 15, I practiced non-violence in jail, and that was my first time to discover like this energy of non-violence, which is really, it's hard to convince people that non-violence work. Mm-hmm. But in my case, it was very personal experience, like on my body and like other people as well.
Yeah, in the context of the prison, it worked. Because yes. You had demands, mm-hmm. then you resisted, like, non-violently, and yeah. then you got...
We got most of our demands, and then we stopped, because the point is really to live in mm-hmm. dignity, not to die. That was not our goal. And that's how I started to also, you know, read and study. I worked in the library about non-violence, about Mandela, the South Africa apartheid system, and other conflicts in the world. And I was drawn to, you know, like to these ideas, actually, that there is another way, there is a different way that we can practice and different struggle strategies than violence. And also, like in a shortcut, I spent 10 years and a half in jail. So all my teenager time was in jail. During that time, my room in my family house was blocked, sealed with iron and cement as a punishment for the family. And as I said, I was active in jail, like in different different ways in jail. I come to conclusions, like one, that there is no military solution for our cause, which is really not easy just by saying that. But that's my experience. Mm-hmm. And the second thing, you know, knowing the trauma and the history and the power dynamic and everything, still I come also to a place where the zero-sum game practically is not going to work. But for me, it's not just practical. It's also morally. I'm in a place where I don't want to see harm or violence to anybody. Obviously, jail is not a peace academy. It's very important to say that, always. But for me, I turned this experience into, like other prisoners as well at that time, we turn it into a place where we create leaders. Because for the Israeli administration, they would use the jail to crush our soul. Mm-hmm. But I think I always felt in the term of power dynamic, despite the physical power dynamic and the history, I always felt like grounded and morally stronger than the police that jailing us.
Okay. Yeah. And also how you also in prison learned a lot about Israeli history, right? You learned more about their experiences and like... Mm-hmm. their worldview. So how did that affect you?
Yeah, so I grew up around Jerusalem, so I know a little mm-hmm. Hebrew, like music, maybe more. But in jail, I studied Hebrew. It was like learn your enemy's language. That's the mm-hmm. truth. You know, many Israelis, they learn Arabic for the army purpose, not mm-hmm. for peace, just to say the truth. And of course, learning the language... definitely affected me to see things from different angles, different narrative to the same story, to the same land. And of course, it's change is not easy. I just want to say that the transformation time is not simple, really. It's very hard because, you know, I was like a good Palestinian guy, like struggling against the occupation, and I needed to make space for the other side story somehow. And it's not easy because for some people, like changing and making space for the other side narrative, it means that you give up your narrative. Actually, it's not true. I'm very grounded in my narrative, in my story, in my community story and my family. But also I'm really from that strong place. I'm very open to hear a different narrative. And by the way, when we speak about narratives, it's not necessarily facts. It's just the story that we grew up with. And of course, that showed me the space, the conflict, the land from all sides of it. So I am aware of also the Israeli side of the story, to say, without agreeing with everything, obviously, mm-hmm. but I know it. Yeah, that definitely helped me to see that we need like a solution that allow both people to practice their belonging to the land, yeah, without one side controlling the place.
Okay. And in the past 2 years, did you find it more challenging to keep that practice, you know, of like staying true to yourself, to your identity, but also giving space to the narratives from the other side? Or did you find yourself in a more difficult position?
Look, maybe for that I have to say, like, for the time, like that experience after 10 years and a half in jail, I decided to promote nonviolence within Palestinian circles. And that's mm-hmm. how that led me and others found Combatants for Peace, which is founded by ex-combatants Israeli that were in the army and they refused to serve in the army at some point, reaching the conclusion that there is no military solution.
Mm-hmm. How did you find each other? Like, how did you find... So, people from the other side who were committed to the same cause.
Yeah, during the Second Intifada, 2005-06, through a friend of ours suggested that we meet Israelis that refuse to serve in the army. We know about mm-hmm. them through the media, actually, because I speak Hebrew as well. And within the Palestinian side, we were also people that calling for nonviolent Intifada. And through that, we met... secretly with these Israelis, actually, not knowing this will create organization or anything. We have secret conversations. It was very also tense and sensitive because we don't trust each other. There is psychological barriers and physical barriers and political and so on. And lots of trauma, like you are talking about ex-combatants. And from the Palestinian side, people like myself that were in jail. And from then we... created Combatants for Peace, and next year will be 20 years of Combatants for Peace, mm-hmm. by the way. We're celebrating that. Through the years, I have to mention that Combatants for Peace turned from mainly men mm-hmm. into an organization, a movement that have women and men as well, and had people that never fought. Yeah, extend the identity of the organization to different people that believe in the cause and believe in the values of the organization, mainly around nonviolence, ending the occupation and create peace between our people and also bring our people together and so on. This is extended to different people that doesn't really have necessarily the background of ex-army or ex-prisoner or so on. So, yeah, and I'm proud to be part of this. And since then, I'm very active in the space of joint organizations. And this brings a lot of challenges and a lot of opportunities as well. Obviously, nothing easy. There is no quick solutions. It's a long, long journey.
Yeah. Okay. I visited you in your office back in May. So I met many of the people and great women that you work with at Combatants for Peace. And there was one project that I like particularly was impressed with. And that's the Palestinian Freedom School. Mm. So this is like an initiative that tries to educate and empower young people from mm-hmm. Palestine, I think between like 19 and 29 mm-hmm. Years old. Yeah. So how are you at Combatants for Peace? What is the reasoning behind it? What is the mm-hmm. idea behind working with the youth in Palestine?
Yeah. So in Combatants for Peace, in the last couple of years, we decided to work with youth. in both sides, actually, separately and jointly, not everything joint. And we know that two sides have different needs. So this project actually started in the Israeli side of Combat and Service in partnership with other organizations, created Medreshet Drors, like Freedom School in the Israeli side with different partners. And then we started the same project in the Palestinian side. We call it the Freedom School, with youth, as you described, like education and trainings and empowering youth actually to be engaged also in nonviolence activism. And we are really excited about this project because, we most of our city are like young, and we definitely want to, I think, inspire young people to there is another way and different model to really face the reality. Because we come from area where militarization is really high, and the hero is usually the fighter.
Okay.
And we need really to create kind of a modeling of nonviolence for the younger generation. And I know from the people that run this project, each time they need like a cohort of 25 people, they actually have so many demands of people want to join, which is maybe strange, but even specifically in the last 2 years. So I'm really proud that our movement has established this work with youth. And of course, we have also a men group and different groups that are not necessarily fighters background. This is alongside with many other projects we do, which we can talk about them if you wish.
And what kind of nonviolent practices is it that you would show young people?
So in the Palestinian side, you know, we come from a long history of nonviolence as well. People don't hear about this in the mainstream media because usually in the media you see the violent side. But, you know, like the term smooth resilience is coming from more nonviolence approach, actually. It's connected to the powerful of being like grounded in the land and the existence in the land and to the olive trees and so many things. And this practice actually exists in Palestine for so long. The first Palestinian uprising against the British colonization was in 1936. And since then, and even before, the practice of nonviolence exists strongly in Palestine, actually. So we teach that as well through different teachers and through different educators. Actually, they teach about nonviolence. And also nonviolence that was practiced in different parts of the world, you know, Martin Luther King and Gandhi and Mandela and Rosa Parks and others. So I think this is very important alongside other elements about identity and history and narratives and so on and conflict resolution. These are not things that people or students learn in the school, in the normal education system. So I think this is a great opportunity for the young to experience, actually, with combatants for peace. Yeah.
Okay. And what do you say to, because I'm sure that Combatants for Peace also receives criticism, also in the Palestinian community of people saying that nonviolence is ineffective or it's a naive approach to the conflict. So what would be your response to that? Or what do you also tell the young people, you know, who are surrounded by violence and then like to teach them that nonviolence is the way they should approach it?
Yeah. As I said before, it's really important to admit that convince people that nonviolence work. It's very hard.
Yeah.
Honestly. Especially people live under the occupation and to face the system that is very violent system by default. To face it with nonviolence, and it's really to prove that it works, it's very hard. And also even harder to say how to make nonviolence attractive to people. It's very hard. I don't really have a quick answers even.
Okay.
But I know from different experiences. We just mentioned South Africa, the African-American struggle with Martin Luther King and Gandhi in India and others in Palestine. There are many like examples of local struggles in different areas that has succeeded actually to achieve its goals. For me, as I said, like it's more personal experience.
Okay, so it's not a strategy. It's more like a way of living in general and not just in relation to the conflict.
Yeah, I believe nonviolence is not just about in relation to the conflict or to the other side, whatever we call it. It's about ourselves, because that practice come a lot from our culture also, and from our different religion of Abrahamic faith. And it's very important for me to promote that. Not just in terms of the conflict, that's one face of it, but for our own sake, because it's easy in any revolution that fighters turn against each other. So we have to balance the inner work and the outer work, I believe. The youth, they study different models and different schools of thought, and you know, like it's hard to change people's mindset, right? But I think it's important to show the model. That's our job, basically, our mission. Really showing this model, so there is another way, and you attract whoever feel curious about this, and we support them. That's maybe our mission, honestly.
Okay.
Not to force any change in anybody.
Okay, and then you do that on the ground with initiatives like the Palestinian Freedom School, but you're also very active in advocating internationally. So you, for example, you just finished a speaking tour in Germany, where you, I think you sat down with one of your partners from Israeli Combatants for Peace, right? And then you discuss and talk about these topics.
Yeah.
So what is the approach of it in advocating internationally, like do you want to convince the people, or like do you want to gain their support of international actors, also with you being part of, you know, EPICON and like joining the EPICON events? What is your goal when you meet with international stakeholders in the conflict?
Just to add maybe to the previous question, like in Combatants for Peace, we're not just like teaching nonviolence in theory. Like there is also practices, like we done in the last few months, like a stand together with our Israeli partners, stand and vigils and like demonstrations for Gaza, specifically. And the Freedom School youth, they joined. So also to enable participation in this political life, right? It's very important, especially that our youth and our people don't really experience this, you know, activism, this kind of activism. So this is really important to say. We're not just talking about it, we're practicing and learning. So
you like also I read something about protective presence. I think that you also just show presence in areas where the
area
Israeli
C.
In area C.
Some of our activists, especially from the Israeli side, to be truth, because of the privilege and the power dynamic, it's easier for them and more safe. They go to Jordan Valley or South Hebron Hills and different areas in West Bank where settler violence is rising so much, to help protect Palestinian shepherds and villages and so on. Because we know before October 7, but more in the last 2 years, like the settler violence become really huge, actually. And it's also supported somehow by the army and the government. And back to your question about the advocacy work we do globally here in Germany and elsewhere, I think it's important for us, for our cause, actually, to gain international support, definitely. Especially our conflict is the most international conflict that exists right now. It's not the only, obviously, there are many conflicts around the world. You know, we feel a lot of solidarity, like to, you know, Sudan, Yemen, other places in Africa, and many places, of course. But somehow our story very, very international. And it's a part of the domestic politics in many countries, right? So I think it's very important for us, actually, not to be alone. We can't make the change alone. We have to ally with different organizations that have different strategy, and to have the global international support as much as we can. that way we could have impact on the decision makers.
Okay. And was there ever like a governmental interference into your organization or the work you do?
So we are non like governmental organization. Obviously, it's grassroots, mm-hmm. and we are doing our duty daily. We don't really have connection to the governments in our region.
Mm-hmm. So it's more that you want to get connected to political stakeholders outside of the region.
Yes, and yeah, yes, because our own existence as a joint organization that against separation system, it's against the system that exists in the place that run mm-hmm. the land from the river to the sea. The system work on separation, based on separation and fear, and we are actually a joint organization, so we build a lot of trust and bridges between Palestinians and Israelis, and we teach also Hebrew and Arabic languages and so on. So it's a whole different model. It's this, so it's coming from a place, you know, like, you know, they say, okay, you can fight the system or build what you want to see in the world. So I think there is two direction here, and we do both. One being in reality, like responding to what's happening, but also being strategic of building what we want to see. I think these two legs goes together, and it's very important. And having gaining international support and local support, of course, in the first place, because we are a local organization, is very important. I think some of our events even became very global, like the joint Palestinian-Israeli memorial ceremony. It mm-hmm. became really global event.
Can you explain what that
yeah.
is?
So among our different projects, there are two ceremonies every year. One is the joint Palestinian-Israeli memorial ceremony, which was called the alternative memorial ceremony for the formal governmental one in the Israeli side. And we started almost 20 years ago, 70 people, and then we have 200 people and so on. In the last years, we have like thousands of people attending physically or by Zoom. Mm-hmm. And this became like the second important biggest event every year after the governmental one. So it's really not a mainstream, but it's really huge. And this is really humanizing the story from all sides, because there is a lot of dehumanization. So Palestinian and Israeli bereaved families come and speak at that event with music and speeches and so on. It's a sacred event, I think, because really this is a lot of people, like when they watch, they transformed in that 1 hour, really, because it's very to grieve together, and you know, it's very emotional and very spiritual event that has a political statement, very strong political statement. It's a call for action as well. And the second event is the Nakba ceremony, which is happening in the last 6 years, which is the Palestinian Nakba of 48. We do it with our Israeli partner every year. It's getting bigger and bigger. So these are two ceremonies we do every year. Become really a base for a future. Actually, the director of the Palestinian Israeli Memorial Day, he said once his wish is really to see this ceremony as a Palestinian Israeli national ceremony in the future. And it's very important for us to dream, even if it looks a bit impossible. And doing it while the occupation and the conflict happening is much harder than. We're not in a post-conflict, right? We're still in it. We're still in the trauma. And unfortunately, the last 2 years has brought so many victims as well, more than before. More like people lost their loved one in the last 2 years, especially in Gaza, but also in West Bank and also Israeli families.
Yeah.
To recognize all the sides of the story without comparing who's suffering more. And, you know, we don't go in that, actually. So I think this work is much more needed now than ever before, in my eyes.
Okay, so yeah. It's more that in the past 2 years, the ideas and the belief behind Combatants for Peace were strengthened? Oh, because I know I asked this question before, but just to get back to it a bit, like how you kind of honor the pain of the past 2 years and still try to do this kind of work, you know, and like the difficulties of it. How in your organizations did you deal with it? Like, did you also, was that a topic that you directly addressed also with the people from the Israeli offices of Combatants for Peace? So did you have any kind of strategies to...
Yeah, of course. Part of why we stayed together in Combatant Service after October 7th, to say, was because we were able to bring our full truth to each other. And we built already in the last 20 years like a strong base of trust among the main first circle, to say, in Combatant Service from both sides, to say. That we have enough trust. We've been in crisis before many times. It's not the first time, but this time was really huge, obviously. And it's very personal also, I have to say, because some of our activists, Israelis in October 7, has lost friends, like Vivian Silver, she's our friend. She was a peace activist. Everybody look at her as a model. She was killed in a Hamas attack. And of course, October 8th until now, like, brought like much more destruction and killing of our people in Gaza. We have Fatima, she worked in the Freedom School with kids in Combatant Service. Her family, her entire family in Gaza, and Ahmed Hilo, one of our main activists also, his family in Gaza, they lost a lot of their relatives in Gaza. And so it's really very personal. And of course, we address the challenges and we speak to each other. We basically looked at this from last year. We done like October 6 and before to speak about the history and the trauma. October 7, the Hamas attack. And October 8 onward, the attack, Israeli attack on Gaza and in West Bank. So we're not really keeping out of the table any important element of the whole thing. So we can speak about it all very openly and sometimes very harsh, and we don't agree on everything. Okay. We're very real people living in the land. And I think that what made Combatants for Peace stay together, because I know some groups has broke after, like, either because of October 7 or because the genocide in Gaza, either. And, you know, this situation, this tragedy, people go back to their tribe. For us in Combatant Service, it was very important to... our strategy is really to hold the space for all the pain without comparing who's suffering more and defending, rather than giving empathy to each other and solidarity with each other and believing in each other also. And this is not all the time. Like, there were also doubts in the first days. So we hold a lot of, like, Zoom calls for our circles, to listen to people and to support people that feel weak and feel like stepping back. And our decision was very clear. We're staying together and we are against violence of all sides, including the people that want to go to the back to the army from the Israeli side. We said no, either us or the army, either us or violence. And that's very important to say, because it's easy to speak about non-violence and love and forgiveness when you are in a privileged place. Yeah. When you got hurt, that's the real test. So this was a really test for us. Since then, we become much stronger, actually, as a movement, and much needed, I have to say, in the last 2 years.
And do you as a movement also have, like, a concrete vision of how a peaceful and a just solution would look like? I mean, there are always, like, a lot of debates, like a two-state solution, one homeland. Is there in your movement, like, one solution you're working towards, or?
So, very honestly and truthfully, Combatants for Peace started, you know, many years ago on, like, the two-state solution, Oslo agreement. Over the years, some people within the movement has changed their ideas because the reality has changed with expansion of settlements and so on. We actually support solutions that based on the right of self-determination for our peoples in the land.
Okay.
Basically. And we'll support any peaceful solution that our people choose. And as I said, there's different solutions. Like one of them is the two-state solution, classic two-state solution. There are people supporting the two-state solution, one homeland or land for all. There are different like solutions. We actually, our model, I think, can serve on all these solutions as model how cooperation can work in a future life of Palestinian Israelis living in good neighborhood than oppressed and oppressor. Because we definitely have to recognize the power dynamic to reach there. And of course, the political imagination of a future has to stay strong. We work on this a lot because a lot of people are losing hope in reality. So I believe there are different models. I'm personally less concerned about what kind of solutions practically. But if what they say, if there is a will, there is a way. And I believe there is enough resources for everybody. There is also history to base our solution also in history, by the way. History is not just a trauma. There is also good memories that our people did live in the past together, especially if you talk about Arab and Jewish. Over the history, they did live together. It's not strange in our memories, in our family's history. I know it's very hard to speak about it now with all the bloodshed and the hatred and the us or them and so on. But I believe in the goodness of our people that can really show a different face of humanity and humanize each other. And this is what we're trying to do.
Okay. And do you think that forgiveness or like overcoming an imbalance of power structures, is it something that you need to be able to approach these kind of nonviolent strategies? Or can you, even if you don't overcome these kind of emotions, can you still commit to, like, you know, humanizing the other, accepting their side of the story, their narrative?
Look, I come from a long history of practicing something we call it sulha, means reconciliation in our culture. And it's very important for me to localize this, all the Western global like concepts and terms in order to reach the mainstream. We have to use the resources that exist in our cultures. And that concept, actually, you come to the table as different sides with the power dynamic, knowing that through that process that heals and that also, acknowledgement is a key here. Acknowledging what's happening and what happened in the past, not ignoring any part, because we're truth and real. And I think what happened in South Africa is a model that we can learn from. That strategy of the Truth and Reconciliation Committee in South Africa is very important to bring it to our cause. Because we speak also now about accountability, like there should be some part of accountability as well in the way for reconciliation. We can't just turn from all the bloody history into loving relationship, right? We have to be like honest and truth. So I think our commitment for nonviolence and humanization is unconditional honesty.
Okay.
For me, this is how I see it. And that's not coming from weakness place, rather from a very strong place, actually. Nonviolence is much harder choice than violence. That's my experience.
Okay. And from your experience, like, what does it take for both Palestinians and Israelis, because you spent like all these years in prison, like 10 years, and you describe this period as like a transformative experience. But when we think about Israelis and Palestinians, you know, who are just living their lives, like, what or like also like people that are joining your movement, what is it that makes them want to join a movement like this? You know, is it a certain experience, you know, because like, do they just have an enlightening moment and are like, okay, I'm going to join a nonviolent movement? Or what is it from your experience that makes them join Combatants for Peace?
I would say different people have different story, different reasons, honestly. Of course, there is common ground somewhere. But when we talk about theory of change, it's hard for me to take, let's say, my story as a copy base and practice it on other people. It's a, you know, like some of my friends in jail, they turn out into very hardcore fighters. So you set some people in the same condition, they will come out in a different ideas. That's how it works. So there are different really reasons. But I think like a common thing here, that people like come to a place where both people exist. This is a harsh fact to recognize, whether people like it or not. The other thing, like, people see what violence brings, just destruction. And with that said, like, the choice of nonviolence and loving and peace and all of that is not really a minute of enlightening, and that's it, and you are a nonviolent person. That doesn't work this way. Rather, I would say it's a long journey, and it's ongoing work. It's like the healing work. It doesn't never end. It's not like one time. Because we have to humanize also, and I'm going to say this very controversial statement. We have, especially we're talking now, after this 2 years specifically and decades of occupation and everything, we have to humanize the fighters. Honestly, without agreeing on violence or anything. But these are people. And these people that were able to practice violence are the same people that able also to transform into peace builders. And that's what happened to us in Combatants for Peace, the first generation of Combatants for Peace. And that's very hard for people maybe to accept this, but I think we want to bring every side to the table of conversations. And we have to work on that and recognize that.
Were there any, in the past 2 years, because there were some soldiers, you know, who were in Gaza and they they talked to Haaretz, for example, like there were reports from soldiers who didn't want to support this anymore. Was there, were there people that also like joined your movement in the past 2 years who were like former combatants?
Yeah, this is very sensitive topic, I have to say, because it's really fresh. Yeah, but we'll speak about it, obviously. It's nothing hidden here. We have different conversations about this specific topic. It's very fresh and very sensitive to accept someone that was in the army right now in Gaza, and we have people in the organization that their family did. It's very sensitive and very harsh and very complex. That's why I mentioned the Truth and Reconciliation Committee in South Africa. There should be some kind of process, some kind of accountability here. Yes, we are in touch with many of these people that you mentioned through one of our leaders in Combatants for Peace that he's in touch with them. And there are different conversations happening right now while we're talking. What to do with these people that refused right now, but they just came out of Gaza. And that's maybe my previous answer was a bit including these people as well and the Palestinian fighters as well. Like somehow now they're speaking about, you know, the ceasefire and hopefully a peace deal, like more than just a ceasefire. Hopefully this is a first step. And rebuilding Gaza, but there should be really part of the plan is really the healing of the community now. Yeah, there are a lot of traumas. And also, what do you do with the people that fought? From the, I'm not comparing, again, this is a different narrative, different story. What do you do, like in other conflicts, what they did with the fighters from both sides? Despite the differences, everything. But what we do with these, a lot of people, Are they out of the table, or shall we welcome them? Shall we have a process? I think these conversations now are very relevant, and we're speaking about it.
Okay.
Yeah. And yeah. I don't really have a final answer even for that myself. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to learn what Mandela did with this, just to get inspiration. I try to learn what the tribal system say, what the international law say. So this is really very important conversation to have, and I hope the decision makers and the stakeholders, also politicians, to think about that as well. It's very important, and it's not just our responsibility as combatants or to do that, but we can provide our experience working with ex-combatants, and I believe this is a key and very important work that must happen. Yeah.
Okay. And so apart from that, apart from the soldiers, I just want to, like, because I want to understand better, like, why or how people decide to join the movement. So yeah. I think from my experience, you know, also a lot of people that I've met through Epicon, like yeah. in the past year, I think a lot of them, they don't have a enlightening moment, mm-hmm. but there is a moment where they meet the other side. So it seems to be a thing that, like, you grow up, yeah. you never really, like, you hear stories yeah. about the other side,
yeah.
you hear stories often of, like, mistrust yeah. and fear, and then it's at a very late stage yeah. that you finally get to meet someone. So as an Israeli yeah. to meet a Palestinian, as a yeah. Palestinian to meet an Israeli, and that's the moment where you also humanize each
yeah.
other.
Yeah.
So should there be, or how could there be, like, more places where these people get to meet?
Well, I agree with you, Mariam. Like, the, how you describe it, it is even worse than that. It's like the meeting point are usually on a checkpoint. So the Palestinian meet Israelis as a soldier with a uniform or a settler. That's really the meeting point.
Yeah.
For Israelis, what they know about the Palestinian is like someone coming to attack us.
Mm-hmm.
Violent. This is really mainly, there are other meetings, obviously, generalizing, but this is more or less the meeting points, which is a dehumanization meeting points already. And of course, the reality and the media and everything. I think meeting the other side, what we call it, and dehumanizing the other side is a turning point in my experience, especially if these meetings happening in a places where it's really well prepared. With a process and so on, because, you know, like, after you humanize someone, you can't really hate them and support in killing them, right? So that's why the system based on separation and fear. And part of what we do, actually, we do different seminars and gatherings and so on, that we bring new people just to come and explore this. And it doesn't have to be like that minute of like enlightenment. For many people, also take a lot of time because they come with a history of doubts and trauma and everything, mm-hmm. which we speak about all of that. I think part of the, hopefully, the future, like now, obviously, we are happy that the ceasefire happened. It's not as we wanted exactly, but like just to, the ceasefire happened, and we hope the reconstruction of Gaza will start soon before the rain started, and because people have no place to go back to, they will have no tents even. And hopefully that process, as a learning from the Oslo Agreement experience, is really to support like meeting places.
Okay.
And to also do a lot of healing work separately and jointly. Hopefully this will be part of the plan now, hopefully.
Okay. And how could international actors support this? Because I feel like also when you look internationally and when you look into media discourses, there's often this narrative that Israelis and Palestinians can't work together because you know, because of all these like bad emotions that they have towards each other. And I feel like in this way, the boundaries are just hardening when the perspective is already, it won't work because they don't work. So what could international actors do? Because we want self-determination for the people. But then what could be valuable support systems from outside that support the beliefs and ideas behind your movement, you know, and the things we talked about?
Yeah, right. So, yeah, first of all, let me say, to say why it's not working, like to create peace between Palestinians and Israelis, we can have actually a million reasons, and that's not an option, I wanted to say. Mm-hmm. For me, that's not an option. It's not a plan. It's not a strategy. This hopelessness.
Yeah.
Okay. I want to go behind hope. Mm-hmm. And not fake hope, real hope. And I want to choose life. And that's where we are. Like choosing life. With the challenges, there is nothing easy. It's not going to be quick or easy. Of course, this is a heavy conflict. It's very harsh. It's really embedded in our blood even. It's very harsh. I want to recognize that. And from that place, to work with that, to transform that, I see possibilities there. And of course, the international community, as we spoke before, this is very international conflict. We have so many duties for the international community to help this change to happen. And, you know, the first thing I wanted to say is learning from the experiences as we human has. Like, you know, people spoke lately about Ireland experience. How did they transform the Irish conflict? There are so many lessons to learning. They put a lot of money, maybe creating a ministry on both sides that responsible for these encounters. I don't know. There are different healing spaces and the processes that can be separate also. It's not, nothing has to be always joint, right? There are different needs on both sides. So I think there is a lot from the international community, and that's why for me, like joining ABICON was very important, because it allow us really to bring our voice to these politicians in Europe and the decision makers, and I feel they are listening. And that's why we did the speaking tour in Germany. And, you know, like, after all, we are here in Berlin now, right? And I studied a lot of history when I was in jail, by the way. And when I see now Israelis / Jewish communities have a good connection with German and the people-to-people, like, even level, not to speak about the government, after everything happened here in history, it's maybe bad to say or sad to say, but like why Palestinian and Israelis can't come together. This is just like a living example now, where we are in Berlin, right? Or the French and the German and so on. The list is going on and on. So I don't think we are exception to this rule. Every conflict zone, they think they are unique and God's hand involved in it, and they can't, it can be solved, and it's either us or them. This is where we have to get rid of these ideas, rather to support the idea that specifically the land where we're coming from, which some friends call it like land with many names, as it's holy, and the spirituality and the energy there and the history and everything and the location and everything, it's like really reflection of the global life system. And that's why we like the awakening that we see around the world, around this, it's not just to save the Palestinian, you know, and the Gazan. I have to say, I'm like happy for the changes, honestly, of the narrative globally. But it's a lot also to do with history of colonization and so many other feelings that we have to recognize, the guilt and the savior and this and that. So it's really very important for all of us, I think, to work to make peace in the land, of many names again, for the sake not just of Palestinian Israelis, rather for the world, because that's really a reflection, a mirror of the world, of the state of the world. And it has a lot of interest of all nations, right? So, our, like, the most sacred thing we can do is really bringing a model that that land never been belonged to one group. As a historical fact, I studied this from Palestinian, Arabic, Islamic history. I come from a Muslim family. I studied it within Jewish text as well, or Israelis. It never been belonged to one group, and it will never be. And the most beautiful thing for me is to see Jerusalem and the land and everywhere, actually, with multicultures. It's much, much more beautiful. Yeah, I don't know why this is impossible. Like, this is, looks strange. Rather, that's the norm that was in our region. It's nothing strange here. Yeah. Think about even Andalusia. Like, of course, I don't want to romanticize the past, but like, Arab and Jewish lived together for centuries, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and we belong to the same roots, right? The same blood, and even the language and the culture. And there are some differences, of course, and some harsh history. But I see, like, the opportunity here that comes even now, after all. Yeah. Yeah, I'm not so just like a dreaming, but I believe this is practically possible. Yeah.
Okay. I think that was a very good a closing remark. If there's anything else like you want to say, or like maybe also with regards to Epicon, like you already gave some messages to Europe, you know, to look at their own like historical context and how it was possible to transform wars into peace. So
Again, I definitely have a gratitude for Epicon for the opportunity to bring Palestinian Israeli speakers to meet with decision makers in Europe. It's really important. And I feel you guys really understand the context very well, honestly. So just giving credits back and gratitude. Without the help of Epicon, we couldn't really have this same level of meetings. And maybe finally, I want to say, like, just as an invitation, actually, for all of us, people think peace is just the absence of violence. That's why for many people, okay, it's finished. Now in Gaza, there's ceasefire. But actually, we have to be honest and true. This is a first step, a very little baby step, like, to stop. To have a ceasefire, obviously, always in all processes, we have to start with ceasefire so we can talk, right? But, you know, while we're talking, not describing the tragedies that happen in Gaza, which is really disasters, obviously. In West Bank, there is also silent war happening. Not just since October 7th, it's before. But obviously, in the last 2 years, has become really increased by both the army, supported by Israeli government, especially part of the Israeli government, are very open about it. Racist and these policies, and settler violence and so on. So I think what we see is like really a beginning of something new, hopefully. It's a ceasefire, but this is not the peaceful solution that we want. We want a real peace, means freedom. And safety for everybody, from the river to the sea. I want our people, both Palestinians and Israelis, to test what it look like if we live in real peace, not just a ceasefire, not managing the conflict. Because what happened now, it proved that managing the conflict is no longer works. So we have to really go to the roots of it. And I believe it's possible. And I see there is international kind of intention now to change the discourse in our region in generally. And work together. If we both claim we love this land, why we're destroying it? Like, look at the settlers. They cut trees, olive trees, that hundreds of years old. I can't believe this is like someone claim in the name of God and they do this. Unfortunately, so my invitation to all of us to really look at our personal and collective work, doing and intention, and really seek real peace and not no violence. That's a good step, but it's not enough. Yeah, and back to October 6th system.
Yeah.
And control system. So I think.
So do you see that here being a big risk right now? That now with the ceasefire, like internationally, people will be like, the bombing stopped, everything is fine, and that it will lose attention internationally?
Yeah, there is a fear that the ceasefire was partly also to stop the international movement and the flotilla and everything happened.
Yeah.
There is a fear, of course. And after a while, we will back to the old system of control and fear and security arrangements. And this is not just a security cause. It's a human cause that needs a solution, that human solution, not just a security solution. We learn from the experience the last 2 years, but even before, the security military solutions are not working. Someone said the other day, I was listening to this Israeli broadcast person, which is even not a left-wing guy. He said, maybe we have to realize, wow, between the river to the sea, we almost 50 of the people, 50% Palestinian, 50% Israeli, almost. So this is a fact. We have to deal with it and to transform it. And I hope the international leaders, that really decision makers, will really help create this dream that we are dreaming on it, like to live free in our homeland. It's as simple as that. No one has the right to take it away. And I believe grounding, and like I believe even the power dynamic, you know, it depends how we look at the power dynamic. Some people are strong with power, with weapons, but some also strong with the values and the grounding, belonging to the land. So I think it's very clear now that like to say, maybe for some people this is a cliche, that we need collective liberation for our people, that whether they are Palestinian or Israeli, whether oppressed or oppressor, we all in this together, and we are very connected. Honestly, I don't see any way out of this than both people feel really they can breathe in the land and practice our like belonging to the land and our self-determination and our freedom, and that's not gonna go away anyway.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you so much, Suleiman. I think one can really see you and Combatants for Peace as an example, because it's almost 20 years that you're doing this work.
This year we are doing a celebration of 20 years.
Yeah. So, very inspiring, I think, for everyone to listen to these kind of movements and stories, that it's possible, you know, to work towards a peaceful and just solution, and that even though it's difficult, it's important to not lose track of it, and for international actors to support these kind of movements and initiatives. So thank you very much for sharing all that with us. And thank you for being a part also of our initiative, and adding your valuable experiences.
My honor. Thank you, Mariam. And thanks, Bekon, really, for this. And I feel like we said, we can't do it alone. So we're learning. I mean, I'm in Berlin, right? I just saw the wall.
Yeah.
And the Charlie checkpoint, and we have similar system, so it's gonna fall and it will change. Yeah, that's my belief. For the goodness of everybody, that's really what's coming from my heart, and I am optimistic. Yeah.
Good.
Thank you.
Me too. Thank you, Suleiman. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Epicon Podcast. Epicon stands for European Palestinian Israeli Trilateral Dialogue, an initiative that creates and fosters dialogue between Palestinian and Israeli peace advocates and European opinion leaders. Epicon is implemented by the Candid Foundation with the financial support of the European Union. For more information, visit the Candid website and follow us on our Epicon social media accounts linked in the description.